Well, good evening. This is an interview for the Michigan Writers Series, Friday, November 22, 2002. I'm speaking this evening with Jack Riddle, who has been a professor of English at Hope College for more than 30 years. Welcome to MSU, Jack.
Oh, I'm very glad to be here. Good. Just had a tour.
Well, good. With all the traffic from the basketball
game.
Well,
that's right. And when you come from a little school in a little town, this is a big deal.
I bet it is. Your bio states that you, quote, grew up in the worlds of sports and the circus, unquote. At what age did you begin writing? And given your background, what led you to become a teacher?
I usually answer, when did I begin writing, with what may sound like almost a snide comment, and that is that I really didn't stop in the sense that I think most people, you know, come onto the planet doing a lot of different things, and then they stop. And I grew up in a family that was really encouraged imagination, creativity, all those sort of those buzzwords. But they really were. They were just incredibly supportive. The teaching part, I think it, since my father was a coach and I grew up in colleges and universities, I just simply knew how much I loved that atmosphere, and I was going to do anything I could not to leave it. So I wanted to get on a college campus almost any way I could, and decided to try to write my way on, and a teaching position opened up, and I took
good.
It.
Good. That makes sense. Yeah. Well, you founded Hope College's Visiting Writer Series in 1985, and over the years you've hosted some very esteemed guests, Gwendolyn Brooks, Billy Collins, Joyce Carol Oates, Charles Wright, and just last month, this year's Pulitzer winner for fiction, Richard Russo. Yep. I know you've turned the series over to others, but what led you to start it?
It was a combination of things, as quickly as stated as I can, I guess. I'd been there at that time almost 15 years, and my wife and I wanted to do something for the school and the community that it really didn't have. And one of those things was we didn't have writers come to campus. The second thing was we were getting so many, especially fine student writers, but little old Hope College, you know, who's ever heard of that place? And I figured one way we could help those students was if we brought in writers, they would discover that we have really fine writing students.
Good.
And so then they would go back and vouch for us. And that paid off.
Have you ever had any trouble convincing writers to visit Holland?
You know, never have. I used to get on the phone and just practically shake, you know, when I was calling. In fact, you mentioned Charles Wright. Charles Wright called back, and Julie, my wife, answered the phone. He said, is Jack all right? He made me feel like I was one of the Beatles. And I would just, and I would. I spoke, maybe my coming across as in great awe of these people, you know, charmed them, or it was endearing to them. Nope, never had any trouble.
Flattery always works,
I'm
sure.
I think so.
Well, knowing that your dad was a college basketball coach and that you played basketball and baseball in college, are your coach poems about your father, or is the coach somewhat of a composite of all those you've known?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and I'm so glad you asked it that way. Well, first of all, you know, I'm going to do this reading tonight, and I hate to draw so many people away from the big opener here at State. And, of course, I went
to
breakfast.
Oh,
yeah, sure. Poetry, right. I went to breakfast this morning, a couple buddies, and they did a play-by-play of my reading tonight. They had a great parody. But the coach poems are my father. The way I put it this way, my dad was a winning basketball coach. However, for my sister and me, what that meant was always the consequences of losing. And the thing was that we felt that consequence on the family if we simply lost a game, that had more of a take on us than anything else. My sister and I used to say that winning was a great relief because we didn't have to deal with the consequences of losing. So this coach that I've created is what I would always have nightmares about, what would happen to my father if he had a losing season. So this poor guy is sort of the quintessential American male slugging his way through a long, cold, losing winter season, you know.
Good.
You mentioned Richard Russo, and he and I talked a lot about that because he's a small-time basketball coach, this character of mine, and Richard tends to write about this small town.
Yeah. Well, then, what about your poem, The Ref? Did you just do the same thing?
Well, what happened was that whole, I started with the coach, and then it became a whole, it's about 80 pages long now. It's like it's written as almost a novel. Each poem just advances the novel through the winter. There are characters all through. I call it Spoon River Anthology meets ESPN. So Ref is one of the characters, and there's a scrub, a guy who never gets in, and there's an insurance person, and there's the ex-cheerleader, and all these characters show up.
Interesting. So like, Do you hope to publish that then?
I keep my fingers crossed.
Oh, good.
The poems get published, but the manuscript itself doesn't. Too many basketball poems, I think, in one manuscript is too much to take, maybe.
Oh, okay.
One at a time.
Well, you know, they've published anthologies of baseball poems, I mean, which you were
in. Yeah, yeah. Anthologies, I think, maybe have a better shot at
Okay. Well, your poem, Good Training for Poetry, presents baseball as metaphor for writing.
Yes.
So is being benched the equivalent of writer's block?
it's the equivalent of being writer's block. That's great. Yeah, that sounds great. It's also the that feeling of I think almost any writer that everybody else is the center fielder or the home run king, and you're simply on the bench, you know, and you're trying to get on the team.
Well, I think the poem is also about what's unknowable.
Yeah.
Too. You know, when you're trying to get at your relationship with your father and your daughter, and
very much
taking to sports. And poetry tries to explain the unknowable.
Yeah, I think so. That's Charles Simic talks about the poetry is the orphan of silence, and it does seem to come out of the unknowable where it starts, and then you're trying to see, maybe I know something after all.
You know? Well, good. Well, in Against Elegies, your chapbook published last year by Ridgeway Press, your poems have strong foci on the personification of death and angels, making them different from the earlier poetry that I've read of yours.
Yeah.
Now, as you grow older, are you beginning to accept your own mortality?
Oh, I'm in the ring with my own mortality.
Okay.
And I know I'm going to lose. But as De Niro, you know, in Raging Bull, said, I never went down, Ray. I never went down. He's going to win, but I never went down.
Well, I think the character in The Man Who Wanted to Change the World is facing, you know, mortality and the issues with getting older and dying and reevaluating one's life. You know, certainly in the lines later that evening, drawing his dinner plate, he felt everything around him leaving, felt himself alone amid the sparkles of dust.
Yeah.
Are you the character in that poem?
I suppose the right answer is to say no, and I suppose the other right answer is to say yeah, for sure, and aren't we all, maybe, in a way. And it also comes out of that frustration with language, that suddenly the word, what would happen if you changed the violent word to a almost nonsensical word when it's applied to the, like he changes gun to sassafras, I think, you know, so I pull my sassafras on you, we just end up laughing. But yeah, I think it's that, I suppose the buzzword there is tension of living amidst this terrible violence, and then at the same time facing one's own everything in the sparkles of dust, and then making the dust at least a sparkle. Maybe that's a desperate desperate move.
Well, that poem's very fitting then in light of all the conflict going on in the world today, and in light of post September 11th and so forth.
It came after it came then, and then I got to read it with Billy Collins in New York at Christmas last year, which was right after September 11th. So it was really a remarkable experience. Really, really was.
Was it a packed house when you read?
Yeah, it was. We had a remarkable audience, and both of us said none of this is going to fix anything, but maybe we can have the world be the way we would like the world to be for an hour and a half anyway, so.
Well, it probably helped people take their minds off of what was going on in the city.
That's what they said for an hour and a half anyway.
Interestingly, Gary Gildner read here last September,
yes.
a few weeks after
September 11. He's an old buddy
11.
Of mine. He always stays with us when he comes through.
Oh, good. I know he's participated in your series a few times.
Yeah.
But he said that he gave a reading in Utah on the evening of September 11.
Oh, my word.
And the organizers had said, well, do you want to cancel? And he goes, no, I'll go through with it. But he figured he'd have, 10 people show up because everyone would be home glued to their television sets. And he said he had like 400 people.
Oh, my goodness.
It's like they wanted to get out. They wanted to do something different.
Yeah.
Something besides sit home and watch the horror unfolding. On
and Billy Collins said that at the time, speaking as the poet laureate, that, these are the times when that uselessness of poetry suddenly becomes useful. So,
Well, the Against Elegies is a very handsome chapbook, but what about the printing of the poems on the folds of the pages? Can you explain that one, please?
This is an interactive chapbook. this forces the person to open it up and feel it and all that kind of stuff. And some of the folds were meant to be amusing. There's one that says, that's Jesus, and then it's right on the fold, and you have to turn it over with the head of a tuna.
Yes,
so
okay.
It does some stuff like that, too.
Interactive.
And most of that was, none of that, this was all a designer's idea, and I liked it. And then we thought it was like if you open it up, it's like trying to refold a map, and you just throw it against the wall and say, what have they done to me?
You'd explain that in email, but I wanted it.
Yeah, real interactive.
Record it digitally.
Yeah.
But I know I kept unfolding and refolding and like, okay, which way does it go again?
Yes.
Yeah, like the frustration with reading a map, which isn't necessarily a good thing when you're reading poetry.
No, I don't think so either.
No, you're not a Michigan native, but you've been here for probably half
your
adult 30
years,
life.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so what does living and teaching in Michigan contribute to your work?
When I came here, the poet that I had studied for about 5 years, like an apprentice thing, that poet's name was Paul Zimmer. When I came here, Paul said to me, I don't want to see any beach grass for 5 years. And, he was right. That sense of don't manipulate this and say, suddenly you're going to write this poem and throw in beach grass. And I think what happens is that it being here clarifies where I'm from a lot more than if I'd stayed where I came from, stayed there. There's just a clarity to my background, my childhood, my culture, my city, Pittsburgh, those things are all much, much clearer to me now. And then Michigan has a harshness of weather that is very appealing. You get tired of it along about February, but the other parts are very appealing. And where I come from in Pennsylvania, the weather is slushier and mushier. It's not as clearly defined. So I think the weather is one of the strongest things for me here, and then the definition of the past.
Good.
Yep.
Now, I know that you will soon have out an anthology, 250 poems.
Yeah, that actually came out a couple weeks
ago.
Yep, it's now on your shelf.
Oh, good. You co-edited that with Peter Schakel.
Yep.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Well, what other projects are you currently working on?
Well, he and I just finished a multicultural literature book, an introduction to literature from a multicultural point of view, plays, poems, fiction.
Okay.
And we finished that. We had already done a book called Approaching Poetry, which was about poetry. And so that project isn't finished. It's now at what's known as the readers, and they will now, it's accepted, it'll be published, but they're now looking it over to see if we need to make any drastic changes, tonal changes, all that kind of thing. But it's supposed to be out sometime 2003.
Okay.
So I hope so.
And good luck with that.
Thank you.
And do you have any more personal projects in the work beyond your basketball poems?
Actually, I'm on sabbatical. My daughter is a visual artist, and she and I are collaborating.
Oh.
And I'm doing poems in relation to her response to her work. She's doing some her art and reaction to the poems. And then we're also going to change the form. If you think this chapbook drove you crazy, we're raising the question of how much does the page lead to people's notions of the poem. So we're taking the poems and we're putting them in frames. We're breaking them down. We're sculpting them. We're making an installation piece out of them. You walk into the poem, blah, blah, blah.
There's so where's that going to be, you hope?
Well, one place, she's got a couple shows coming up, one in Amherst, Massachusetts, so some of the work will probably be there. One in Pennsylvania, some of the work will be there, I think. So we'll see.
Sounds really interesting.
But mostly it's been great to do this father-daughter thing.
I bet. Well, I hope that's a success for both
of you.
Yeah,
thank you. Thank you.
And good luck again with that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Jack,
for participating. Oh, thank you, Stephanie. It's been really fun.
Thanks very much. Thank you for participating in the MSU Libraries Michigan Writer Series.
More than welcome.
Good luck with your reading tonight.
Thank you. It'll be fun.